for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Congressional negotiators trying to smooth out differences between the House and Senate health insurance reform plans certainly have their hands full. One issue, the Senate proposal to tax high-cost employer-provided health plans, has attracted particular attention. President Obama supports it. Labor leaders are opposed. Joining me to talk about the divide, Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for Time magazine, Elise Gould. She's director for health policy research at the Economic Policy Institute. Joining us by phone from Lexington, Massachusetts, Jonathan Gruber. He's professor of economics at MIT. He's a technical consultant to the Department of Health and Human Services. We do invite your calls and comments. Questions, do join us by phone, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. If you like, join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to you, Karen. It's good to have you here.
Good morning.
Elise Gould, thank you for joining us. And Jonathan Gruber, I'm glad you're with us.
Thank you.
Karen, let me start with you. Tell us about these so-called Cadillac health plans. You know, we toss that phrase around and people don't really understand it.
Well, the first thing that you have to understand is that the cost of health care is very uneven across this country. In some places, it costs a lot more to get the exact same services that you can get for less money in other places. So as a result, the cost of insurance across the country varies widely. And what this tax would do is it would put a very large excise tax on plans that cost more than $8,000 for single employees and $23,500 for families. These are, they're called Cadillac plans, but in fact, the people who have these kinds of insurance plans are not necessarily, they're not all partners at Goldman Sachs. They are, in a lot of cases, union members who have bargained for these benefits and given up wages to get these benefits. In some cases, they are people, say, the sole proprietor of a law firm who is maybe a guy in his 50s who has somebody in his family who has diabetes. Well, for him to go out and buy a health insurance policy, or for a small business, often the cost is much, much higher because of the specific health conditions that are being covered. Older people cost more than younger people. So you really get a wide variance across the country in who it is who has these so-called Cadillac plans.
Karen Tumulty, she's national political correspondent for Time magazine. Elise Gould, Karen was talking about the factors that can determine the particular cost of a plan, but $8,000 to $23,500 seems really quite a wide range. Give me some idea of the kinds of issues that go into determining cost.
Sure. Cost of plan is determined by several different factors. One of them is, as you said, there are regional factors. They're determined by what area of the country that you live in. So you could live in a high-cost area, and that means that you're going to have higher premiums for the same coverage as you might get in a low-cost area.
Give me a sense of high-cost area versus low-cost.
So in New York, let's say, a very high-cost state. So that it's a high-cost state for various reasons. The cost of living is higher, but also the cost of medical services is going to be higher. So that's one reason, the regional differences. Another reason, as she stated as well, is the kind of firm that you're at. So let's say a very small firm that has some unhealthy workers in it or has some older workers in it, you're going to find that they pay higher premiums for the same coverage that you might get at a larger firm. On average, research has shown that you could pay 20% higher premiums at a small firm than you would pay at a large firm.
Elise Gould, she's Director of Health Policy Research for the Economic Policy Institute. Jonathan Gruber, let me turn to you. I gather that you have been working as a consultant to the Department of Health and Human Services. What kinds of services do you provide?
In that context, I've been helping the administration and via the administration Congress with technical questions about how different structures of this health reform bill might affect government costs and health insurance coverage.
So can you tell us then what percentage of employer-provided plans might be considered Cadillac plans?
Yeah, it's funny. I actually haven't worked at all in that role with the administration on modeling the Cadillac tax. Here I've really just relied on model results from the Joint Tax Committee like everyone else does. And they tell us that initially about 15% of plans would be considered Cadillac tax plans, and by 2019 it would be about 30% of plans would be in that category.
And what assumptions do you make that go along with this proposed tax plans?
Well, I think the important point, Diane, is to recognize what Elise said, that there are a number of reasons why these costs vary. Elise listed a couple, but she didn't list all of them. There are two other reasons why costs vary. One is that plans are sometimes much more generous. In fact, all the examples that people have shown of plans which would pass the Cadillac tax threshold are very generous plans, plans with no deductible and very small charges when you go to the doctor. Another reason costs vary is because employers may be more or less aggressive in negotiating with insurers. So while I think Karen and Elise both did a good job sort of laying out, if you will, the arguments against the Cadillac tax in that it might hit firms which have costs that are high for reasons beyond their control, I think it's important to remember that firms have costs that are high for reasons that are under their control as well. And the whole reason that this has really been the only validated curve-bending approach in the bill is because we think that it's going to get firms to shop more effectively for health insurance and lower the cost of health care as a result.
So then what are the revenue projections associated with this tax?
The revenue projections are about $150 billion over the next decade. Once again, those aren't my projections. That's just from the Joint Tax Committee. And the Joint Tax Committee projects that most of that revenue, about 80%, will result from firms reducing the cost of their insurance plans in response to this tax and, as a result, raising their workers' wages.
They raise workers' wages to offset the tax that they might have to pay?
Basically, what they're doing is, indirectly, yes, but the way it works is we think, and a past evidence supports the notion that there's a trade-off that employers make between the cost of health insurance and the wages they pay their workers. When the cost of health insurance goes up, they pay their workers less. When the cost of health insurance comes down, they pay their workers more. In this case, firms would say, look, these expensive plans are now too expensive because of the excise tax. I'm going to fall below that threshold. And the money I save, if I fall below that threshold, I'll pass back to my workers in the form of higher wages.
Jonathan Gruber, he's professor of economics at MIT. He's also a technical consultant to the Department of Health and Human Services. Elise, explain why labor leaders are so opposed to this tax on Cadillac plans.
Well, we've seen that that labor unions, that workers, have decided pointedly to bargain and get benefits over increases in wages. So over time, they are getting more generous, more comprehensive coverage because they don't want to take on the individual risk. So what they'd rather do is have more comprehensive coverage so that if they do have a health catastrophe for themselves or for their family, or if they have someone in their family who has a chronic condition that they know is going to be expensive, they would rather have insurance companies pay for that as opposed to taking on that financial risk. So over time, they have bargained for those benefits. And so they're against this excise tax because it's going to cut into those benefits that they have so hard bargained for.
Karen Tumulty, is that fair?
Well, I think there are a couple of issues here. There's a lot of skepticism among workers and some economists that if you lower the employer's cost of health insurance, that that is in fact going to end up in the back in the worker's pocket, maybe just a different pocket. And again, I've seen economic analysis on both of these, and I don't have the expertise on both sides to really say which of these is true. Another is an issue that John sort of got at indirectly, which is that this tax is going to be indexed according to normal inflation. And healthcare costs are rising faster than normal inflation, so that with every passing year, more and more plans would fall under this tax. Now, John is right. This bill actually, it does a good job of covering people. It does probably an effective job of clamping down on the insurance industry and preventing them from doing a lot of the practices that people object to. But it has very little in it that would go at the things that have been driving healthcare costs up. And this is one of the few things in the bill. It's only in the Senate bill. It's not in the House bill. And that's why the administration and the Senate is so anxious to hold on to this.
And how successful do you think they might be?
I think there's a deal here. I think that the president is making it very clear that he wants this in the bill. Ultimately, what is probably going to happen is that the threshold of what is defined as a Cadillac plan is going to be raised, and possibly something I think might be done with indexing and, you know, grandfathering a few plans or something like
and
that.
Wouldn't you combine salary with that? In other words, if you made $1 million and you had one of these Cadillac plans, couldn't you be taxed more? That's one of the questions we'll deal with after a short break. And joining us now from Washington, D.C., Gerald Shea. He's Special Assistant to the President for Healthcare for the AFL-CIO. Good morning to you, Gerald. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane.
Can you talk about what your objections are to the Senate's plan on Cadillac health plans?
This tax would, by government estimates, hit about 31 million people by 2016. Most of the revenue would come from people who are in between $100,000 and $200,000. Now, this is not just a tax on union plans by a long shot, since we represent less than half of that number of 31 million people. So most of the people who will be hit here are not union plans. They are people who have expensive plans because they do provide decent coverage of health benefits, but also, as some of your guests were explaining, because they may live in an expensive part of the country, or they're of an age where there's additional. We all use more health services as we grow older. Women have been charged more for health care. So there are a number of factors beyond the control of the individual, and that's how this tax would hit. It's a very blunt instrument, and the tax money is being raised to pay for coverage for the uninsured, and we strongly support, have supported for decades, the idea of establishing universal coverage in the country. But we don't think it's necessary to go to a tax on the middle class in order to pay for that. And The economists estimate that either people will have to pay a tax, and the tax is 40% on insurers, and it will be passed on, everyone assumes, to insurance policyholders, or they will have their benefits cut. And the idea that middle-class Americans are going to have their benefits cut, like lose dental insurance, lose vision insurance, lose their flexible spending accounts, as a result of health reform, is just unfair, and it's unnecessary.
So help me understand, of the 31 million you talk about who make between 100 and 200,000 and have these so-called Cadillac tax plans, how many union workers currently have these plans?
Some of our members do, but Diane, our best estimate is it's 3-4 million members.
3 to 4 million members. Jonathan Gruber, would you agree with that?
I don't have a good estimate, but I think that what Jerry's leaving out of his argument is to remember that today, those very same plans that will get hit by the Cadillac tax already get an enormous tax break from the U.S. government. The U.S. government spends $250 billion a year subsidizing employer-provided health insurance. The Cadillac tax, if you look at it compared to what the government's going to spend, is 5% of the existing government subsidy we provide to these tax plans. So all we're saying is, can we shave back by 5% the $250 billion giveaway we give to employer-sponsored health insurance, and can we use that, take that money, to cover low-income people who have no health insurance?
Jerry Shea?
I don't see how that's a bad deal.
Want to comment?
Yes, thank you. We think a much fairer way is the way the House has approached this, which is to apply a millionaire's tax, to ask a little bit extra from the people who made out so well from the economic boom times from the mid-'80s on. And that millionaire's tax would raise plenty of money, much more money than this excise tax.
What about that, Jonathan Gruber? Many people have made that argument that you don't need to tax health care plans. What you need to tax is high salaries.
I have no problem with that being part of the financing package. I think I completely agree with Jerry that that we should have very progressive financing. But what that argument misses is a goal of this bill is not just to cover the uninsured. It's also to try to deal with cost control, which is a very difficult issue. And the Cadillac tax is the one step that's been endorsed by the CBO and others as being a legitimate way to approach cost control.
Karen Temelty, do you want to comment?
Well, I would say, and John, just, you know, contradicting me, if this tax isn't hurting, it's not changing behavior. So, I mean, if what you see is a, you know, an effort to change the way people buy health insurance, the way they use health care, you're not going to get there with an income tax.
So what you and Jonathan are saying is, if you put a tax on these Cadillac plans, you're going to change behavior. How sure can you be of that?
Well, I'm not the expert here. So, you know, it does seem, however, those the people at the Congressional Budget Office think it would, and a lot of economists like John think it would. And a number of economists signed a letter to the president, a number of Nobel Prize winners, and who, again, say it would. But there are economists on the other side as well.
Jonathan, how would it change behavior?
It would change behavior because one way that employers would react to this excise tax is by lowering the generosity of their health insurance plans. And in particular, we think that many health insurance plans in America provide benefits which don't give any incentive for a cost-effective medical care use. And this would address that by providing an incentive for employers to search out more cost-effective insurance plans and get people to use health care more appropriately, which is ultimately what we have to do if we're going to lower health care costs in America.
Jerry Shea, how do you respond?
Well, Jonathan's last point that we have to reform health care in terms of its cost and appropriateness and effectiveness is absolutely true. And we have worked on, as he has and others have, parts of this bill that go at those very issues. But this tax does not. And I would just contest his point that he's made several times now, that there it's possible to go shopping for cheaper plans. Believe me, we negotiate benefits Our unions negotiate benefits for 40 million covered lives. That is all of our members and their family members. We work closely, and we've been working closely for years with employers to try to get health costs down. There's no such thing as going out and finding a cheap plan. Plans are expensive because the health care delivery system is expensive. That's what we've got to go after. This tax does not do that. All this will do is either cut benefits or put a tax on the middle class. And, Diane, we haven't spoken about the politics of this yet, but we believe, based on our conversation with people around the country, our members and other people, that there'll be a middle-class revolt over this. The idea that health care, which is already too expensive for many families, will now cost more money to them or they'll have to do with less health care is just people are astonished when they hear that this is
all
being
right.
Part of
Karen, you wanted to comment.
I absolutely agree that the politics of this are treacherous, and that's one reason that three-quarters of the members of the House Democratic Caucus have signed on to a letter written by Congressman Joe Courtney of Connecticut saying they're going to oppose this, because unlike this big fight that we had over the public option, that was all about establishing something new. With this tax, you're actually asking people to give up something they have, which is the tax-free treatment of their health care benefits. And I do agree that the politics here are difficult.
Elise.
I want to step back for 1 second because we're calling this a Cadillac tax. And I just want to be clear that this is not necessarily a tax on Cadillac plans, what we would consider very high quality or comprehensive plans. Cadillac plans, in the way that the tax is constructed, is just expensive plans. And again, expensive plans aren't necessarily the same thing as comprehensive plans or high quality plans. They have some relationship. And that is true that one of the factors that goes into the what how your premium is priced is the comprehensiveness of coverage. But research has shown that less than 4% of the variation in premium pricing is actually due to that comprehensiveness of the plan. So the other factors, the size of your business, the age of your workforce, the health status of your workforce, the state that you live in, those factors have an even more important role than actually what you're talking about, the generosity or comprehensiveness of the plan. So to call it a Cadillac tax, I think, sort of reinforces that myth.
Jonathan, do you agree with that, that we need to be very careful about these terms?
I agree we need to be careful about these terms, but I think what Elise didn't mention is the fact that we already give these plans an enormous, enormous tax break. And all we're talking about is scaling it back. Now, I realize I completely agree with Karen that the politics is ugly, and that's why I think it's an incredibly brave and important thing that President Obama did in laying down a marker on this issue, because the politics is tricky. But unless we're willing to take on the kind of runaway entitlement that this $250 billion a year tax break provides to employers, then I don't know how we're ever going to get health care costs.
Jerry Shea, have you had an opportunity to speak directly with the president about this?
Yes.
And give me your reaction to what he has said.
I think that was Jonathan who was answering for me. Actually, I haven't personally spoken to the president.
Okay.
My president, Richard Trumka, has. I've spoken extensively to his staff, the people who are leading the healthcare effort at the White House.
And what indications are you getting?
That the president does believe what Jonathan was saying, that this would help control costs. Unfortunately, I think he's being misled by people on this. I think we have a economic theory here which really doesn't fit reality. I mean, one point is this notion about employers would give raises to people in lieu of health benefits. I think that's extremely naive. And I can tell you, Diane, when I speak with employers and employer groups, as I do quite often, and I raise this very point, they laugh in response. They said in this economic times, the idea that employers would increase wages because they were able to spend less on health care, they said, absolutely not.
Elise. Okay, go ahead, Jonathan.
I just want to say that this point, but there I have a quote here from, for instance, from Ask Me, which is a pretty important union in the U.S., saying reform reduces health care costs and provides more money from wages. So unions themselves in their negotiations have made this point. It's not a point that's limited just to egg-headed ivory tower economists.
Elise.
So I think we would all agree that it's better to improve the quality of healthcare and improve have cost containment measures through healthcare delivery system reform. We would hope to see that. The question is, how are you going to get at cost containment? And I just want to be clear, so everyone understands that's listening, is that you get cost containment from this excise tax because people, by and large, are going to shift to less expensive plans. And all else equal, when you shift to a less expensive plan, you're going to get less comprehensive coverage.
And
what does that mean?
And you believe that that's going to happen with this kind of tax.
Right. People are going to try to avoid this 40% tax. It's a very high tax. And so they're going to avoid it, and they're going to target perhaps even just to that threshold amount to have hit their premiums there. And as I said, all else equal, that means that you're going to lower the comprehensiveness of your coverage. And what does that mean? That means you're going to be paying higher deductibles, higher copays. You're going to change the structure of your insurance. It passes the risk on to workers and their families. And so they're now going to be bearing more of that out-of-pocket burden.
Jonathan Gruber, do you agree?
I absolutely agree that a major reaction to this bill will be to increase the out-of-pocket burden on individuals buying health care. But I think we have to remember what we're talking about. We're not talking about putting anyone at risk for underinsurance. We're talking about taking people who now pay very little for their health care and ask them to pay something. And to use the money we raise, take people who pay everything for their health care and ask them to pay less. And once again, that's the trade-off here. We're going to take money, ask people to pay a little bit more to provide money to those who now have no coverage at all.
Jonathan Gruber, he is professor of economics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We'll open the phones. Can you stay with us, Jerry?
I can.
Okay, let's go first to Bath, Michigan. Good morning, Scott. You're on the air. Scott, are you there? All right. Instead to Edwardsville, Illinois. John, good morning.
Good morning, Diane. My question is, I've heard a lot of discussion about how this might impact employees. My question is there any consideration with regard to retirees who are getting good health care plans from their prior employers?
At least.
Would employees be exempt? The retirees be exempt?
I think one of the arguments that you heard John Gruber make is that when they cut back on health insurance, that active workers will then see a wage increase. You can't make that trade-off argument at all for retirees. They can't get a trade-off in increased wages.
Jonathan Gruber.
That's absolutely right. The retirees will, for retirees, this will be a hit on them that's not compensated by a wage increase.
It's going to be a hit on them in what sense?
Well, basically, firms will react to this by providing less generous insurance. Once again, not putting anybody at risk for underinsurance or medical bankruptcy, but taking people who aren't paying much for the medical care now and having them pay some of it.
Jerry Shea.
Diane, our conversations with employers, they have been explicit with us that if this tax is imposed, they will simply eliminate retiree health benefits altogether. They are not going to start paying for retiree health benefits without the business deduction that they now have. So,
but what about those retirees who are already in place? Surely you're not saying that opportunity to continue would be cut.
No, I believe that it would be. We've been losing retiree health coverage rapidly over the past 20 years. We're down by two-thirds in about the last 15 years, Diane. And unions have done a better job than the non-union populace of maintaining this retiree health coverage. But even we have been hit. And the reaction, as I said, that we've heard from employers is they just want to cut this out entirely.
What about that, Jonathan Gruber? What do you say to employees who've worked for 20, 25 years who've been promised that health care would continue because of their longevity?
Well, I make two points. First of all, this bill includes reinsurance funds to help exactly that group of retirees with the cost of employer-provided retirement insurance, so that will offset any pressures towards reduced retiree insurance to some extent.
What kind of costs would go into reinsurance?
Basically, what this is essentially saying, if you're a firm and you have retirees that are covered by a retiree plan that have excessive spending, the government will help you pick up the cost of that excessive spending, therefore lowering the financial pressure on you from having a retiree plan. So that will offset to some extent what Jerry's talking about. But I think, once again, what I disagree with Jerry's contention, this will blow away retiree coverage. Remember, if you have a plan that, let's say, costs, let's do an example, let's say it costs $25,000. Okay, so it's $2,000 above that threshold. We're talking about right now, the typical worker in that plan is getting a $9,000 tax break. Okay, and so instead, that tax break would fall to maybe about $7,900. So there's still a huge benefit to that group getting that retiree insurance. It's just scaling back what they already have. It's not suddenly making it financially unattractive.
Jonathan Gruber of MIT, Elise Gould of the Economic Policy Institute, Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine, and Gerald Shea. He's Special Assistant to the President for Healthcare for the AFL. CIO. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. By the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. By Jeffrey Kenner, in appreciation of NPR's international coverage and its foreign correspondents. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Amid signs the recession is ending, one author sees an explosive global economic boom on the horizon. The good news, more prosperity and freedom. The bad news, more stress and insecurity. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we've been talking about the so-called Cadillac healthcare plans, plans that cost between $8,000 and $23,500, what they provide, why they are provided, why the unions are against taxing those kinds of employee healthcare plans. Let's go to Pete in Rochester, New York. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Several points on the issue and a question for you if time permits. Average working class people in this country haven't seen a raise since 1973. A partial list of reasons for that is, A, the free trade agreement, which reaped huge wealth into the, transferred huge amounts of wealth into the pockets of the owner and investor class. Second, productivity has increased exponentially over the last 30 years, but again, wages have not gone up. Average working people have not seen raises because the employers are paying increased cost of health insurance. Again, another transfer of wealth to the owner and investor class. If the president is concerned about, if he's going to be held to two of his promises during the campaign, one, not increasing taxes on people earning under $200,000 a year,
and B, hold to his promise that he would not sign a health care bill that did not include a strong public option to keep costs under control.
All right, so your question, Pete.
The question for you is, I'm wondering, when are we going to have labor represented on your program? I know today you had somebody on for a couple of minutes.
No,
but you frequently
Pete. We've got Gerald Shea from the AFL-CIO. He is still on the line with us. Would you like to ask him a question?
Yes, I'd like to ask if he is going to hold the line with the president on these two points, that the that his promise that he wasn't going to hold or wasn't going to raise taxes on
people
raise $200,000 a year, and a strong public option
okay.
to keep the health care cost under control, which is what his reason is for raising the taxes on the Cadillac health care plans.
All right, Jerry Shea.
Thanks, Pete, and I appreciate your question. You may know about some of the activity in your own area. The AFL-CIO and our member unions have mounted the biggest mobilization we've ever done on any issue this year on health care, and it follows on our advocacy of national health reform, genuine health reform, really for decades. We are fighting very hard for the public option. We're fighting very hard for people to be able to maintain the coverage that they have and for no taxation of benefits. We are strongly in support of progressive financing. Today, we are organizing having our third National Call Congress Day. People all over the country are calling Congress with this request, and we are pulling out every stop in terms of the pressure that we can put on. And as somebody mentioned earlier, I think it was Karen Tumulty, the Congress has really responded. A lot of people have been educated on this issue, and almost 200 members of the House of Representatives have signed a letter saying that they don't think it's right to tax benefits and they don't want to be asked to vote for a bill that does that.
Karen.
Pete also gets to what I think is a big political problem here for the president, which is that if I don't think there was any single campaign promise that he repeated more often than his promise not to tax the middle class. And the White House tries to argue, well, this isn't really a tax on the middle class. This is a tax on insurance companies. But the fact is, you know, this is a tax that is going to be felt by a lot of middle class people.
I wonder, Elise, does the Cadillac plan apply to Congress?
Depending on the plan that they choose, people in Congress or federal employees could very well be choosing a plan that would be affected, perhaps not in the first year, but we have talked about the indexing. Into the future, more and more plans will be affected, so that by 2019, the JCT has estimated that 30% of all health plans will be affected. Clearly not all Cadillac plans. You're affecting many ordinary health plans.
All right, let's go to Little Rock, Arkansas. Mike, good morning.
Good morning to you. Obviously, a tax has got to be imposed. We've got to have a way to pay for the changes and the attempt to try to increase coverage to folks in America. If you tax the rich and take that money and dump it into current plans that folks have to help offset their costs, you do absolutely nothing to that individual to understand the cost of care. All they know is now they're paying less. Nothing changes. By changing the structure and having folks to look at their plan, even a small change, a $10 or $15 change, studies show, and the cost of drugs will cause employees and users to say, well, let me get that cheaper drug, or let me ask if there's a cheaper drug available. So I think if you're going to tax, and you're going to have a tax, you've got to get something out of it. You got to make some headway. What my concern is, and I think what we should be talking about is, when labor and large lobbying groups push the president around and say, we want to be exempted. Yeah, you can do this, but leave us out of it. How does then the president come back and say, we're all in this together, we're trying to make a change for the entire population of the U.S., except for these folks? These
Jonathan Gruber.
Well, I think, you know, the caller makes a very good point, which is, you know, and it's a point Karen made earlier, which is cost control is really hard. And if we're going to do cost control, we're going to have to change people's behavior. If we don't want to change people's behavior, that's fine. We'll just continue to spend more and more of our national income on health care. It's going to be hard. The problem with making hard decisions is there's affected groups who want to be protected. And I think the caller points out the trade-off between taking those hard decisions and protecting groups that could make it difficult for you politically.
Karen.
Well, you know, I think the fact that everybody's having to sort of twist themselves into knots over this issue, it goes back to probably the biggest issue of all, which is that we have a healthcare system in this country that was a historic accident that came around about in World War II, where most people get their health benefits through their employer in the form of tax-free income. And certainly, you know, Jonathan has argued for over a decade that this is one of the major reasons that our system is so inefficient in how it allocates resources. So we go back to the fundamental decision that the president made at the outset of this, which is rather than trying to design an entirely new system from the ground up, he was going to try to take the system we've got and build onto that. And that is one of the reasons we find ourselves in these very complicated arguments.
But, Jerry Shea, that would be why you would argue for simply a tax on those making $1 million and more, rather than taxing those employee health plans.
That's right, Diane. And the president did make a decision, and we've all supported it, to build on the plan, the health care as it's now delivered and paid for in the country. And the backbone of that is employment-based coverage, the kind of coverage that we're talking about that would be hit by this tax. And I think the old medical adage of first do no harm is what should apply here. Karen makes an excellent point about the historical accident that led to the way we finance healthcare. And John's point is in terms of tax theory, is absolutely correct. This is a nonsensical way to do it. But it is what we have, and we have to deal from the situation that we're in. And we can talk about changing behavior. I think everybody recognizes there's more individual responsibility that needs to be taken, including by union members, but we need to bear in mind the limits of that. You know, 80% of the money that we spend every year on health care goes to 20% of the population, one-fifth of the population, the people who are the sickest, the people who have chronic diseases and multiple chronic diseases consume 80% of the health dollars. There's very little those individuals can do to make any difference in those health expenditures. They are trapped in a very bad health status and subject to the system that they're dealing with. We have to make system change. And when I referred to the cost containment provisions in the legislation before that we've supported, that the administration has worked for, there are a lot of cost containment elements. It will take time to put them into effect, but we have the building blocks to make a more efficient, higher quality system. And that's where the hope is in terms of controlling costs. There's not a silver bullet on this.
I find myself wondering whether that silver bullet and whether that unknotting of hands might have been a national health care system, Jonathan Gruber.
Well, I mean, certainly that's a very different conversation, Diane, and a single-payer system would deal with a lot of the problems we're talking about. It just was never a starter in this debate. I think, as Karen pointed out and others have said, the notion was that we've tried for many, many decades to sort of fundamentally rip up our system and start over. It's never worked politically. The notion this round, and the reason we've gotten farther than ever before, is because we recognize we need to build on what works. It started here in Massachusetts. We put in a system which built on what worked and moved us very close to universal coverage in the state. That said, you still need to take at least baby steps towards that next phase, and I would view this Cadillac tax as one of those baby steps.
Elise.
The caller mentioned that we want to make people more cost conscious, right? People should bear some more of that burden so that they will spend their dollars more cautiously, but not necessarily more wisely. Do people have the information to spend their health dollars more wisely? Isn't clear. And when we look at the population, we see that there are some people who don't spend very much. They're going to not be very affected by this at all. But for people with chronic conditions, people with high medical needs, they could be strongly affected by that. And the excise tax could cause them to cut back on medically important and cost-effective medical care. The caller specifically mentioned increasing co-payments on prescription drugs. When you increase co-payments on prescription drugs for people with chronic conditions, you actually increase their emergency room usage. You increase their hospital usage. You could actually lead to worse health for these people.
All right.
There are some real effects for a small group of people.
Let's hear from someone who's in that situation. George is in Virginia Beach. Good morning to you, sir.
Good Good morning, Diane.
Go right in.
Well, this is a subject that's pretty dear to me. I've paid really a lot of insurance premiums in the last 20 years. I'm diabetic, and I'm an employer. And specifically the Cadillac tax, which is, I think, the main subject today, is what I'm calling about. I've paid as much as $20,000 for minimum coverage for one family in a year. And to the idea that I would be have an additional tax after paying $20,000 to insure one employee's family is just appalling. And I believe Jonathan said, "Oh, it wouldn't really cost me something," but Gerald seemed to feel that it was out of place. And so my question is, how in the world can Congress consider increasing the cost of already exorbitant medical insurance on small employers through this tax?
Jonathan.
I think it's very important to recognize that doing this in a vacuum is very different than doing it in the context of the overall bill. The overall bill will do wonderful things for businesses like George's in terms of allowing them to buy into an exchange with community-rated insurance where they can't be charged exorbitant prices just because workers are sick, and they can't be charged excessively just because of worker age. And a lot of the concerns small businesses now have about their high premiums will be addressed fundamentally by the insurance market reforms this bill puts in. It's true that after those reforms, some firms will still have costs that will hit the Cadillac tax threshold, but many, many fewer, and it won't be because their workers are sick.
Jerry.
Well, you know, Congress is often looking, with all due respect to the members that we elect, Congress is often looking for the easy, simple answers. And they found in this theory, which proponents like Jonathan have been putting forward very aggressively, they found a simple answer, a silver bullet. We can tax benefits, raise some money, it won't be too big a burden, and it will reduce health costs. All unproven assumptions about this, and that was just attractive to Congress, and it's been more attractive than taking on the insurance companies or taxing people who make a lot of money.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Jonathan, do you want to respond?
I mean, I think basically, once again, I don't disagree with Jerry that we need to have progressive financing. I think a combination of the House and Senate makes sense. But what I think that we have to recognize is this is a really once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to start taking on an enormous entitlement, which has cost the government $250 billion a year and which contributes to our ever-rising cost of health care, growing cost of health care. And if we can't take it on now, I don't know when we're ever going to take it on.
Jerry.
Diane, this bill is about health care. We've been trying for decades to get universal coverage, to make sure everybody has access to good quality care. It is a health care reform bill. It's not an entitlement reform bill. It's not a deficit reduction bill. It's not a tax reform bill, as some other people want to turn it to. This is a health reform bill, and we have to keep our eyes on the prize.
All right, let's go finally to Manchester, New Hampshire. Good morning, John.
Good morning. I just don't understand how, in the eyes of the Senate majority, that this is better to their constituents than a public option. It doesn't seem to address costs at all. Giving people less coverage to keep them under the Cadillac cap doesn't seem to go after the root cause of our health care ills, which are rates going up 10 to 15% every year.
All right. Karen.
Well, certainly the Congressional Budget Office did score a public option, a strong public option, as something that would have saved a lot of money. But the politics didn't work, and I think at this point that option is gone.
Why didn't the politics work?
I think in part because both sides decided to demagogue the argument rather than deal with this as a, you know, it was a relatively small feature of the bill to start out with, but it suddenly became a big ideological test, I think, for both the left and the right.
Jonathan Gruber, no chance ever of getting this in our lifetime?
No chance of getting the public, the single payer, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, once again, public option is very different than single payer. I wouldn't say there's no chance of a public option. I think there's no chance of a single payer in our lifetime. I wouldn't say there's no chance of a public option. I mean, I think basically it was just too much for this bill to carry. But I think we'll go forward and we'll be studying competition insurance markets. And I think if competition insurance markets is viewed as limited, I could see the public option debate coming right back up again.
And do you believe, Jonathan, that we are going to get this tax on these so-called Cadillac care plans?
I believe we are, because I think the president's made a priority, and because it is, as I said, the one recognized step we can really take towards cost control in this bill.
Karen, do you believe we will get it?
Yes, it'll hit fewer people, but it will be in there.
Elise?
Unfortunately.
Yes.
Unfortunately, yes. I mean, I think it's very poorly targeted, but I think it may be a feature in the final bill.
And Jerry?
Our president's met with the president on Monday, and they had a very constructive discussion. The president said, I believe that this tax would help on health costs, but I don't want to do it in a way that hurts working families. He asked us to work with them. Those discussions are going on today.
All right.
And we hope it won't hurt working families.
All right. Last word, Gerald Shea of the AFL-CIO, Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine, Jonathan Gruber of MIT, Elise Gould of the Economic Policy Institute. Thanks to all of you. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.